America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. And, Chris, I am getting an incredible echo in my headphones. I don't know what's going on there, but huge echo. Greetings to the program. The White House has found a war czar. I guess I can stop lobbying for my having that job. We'll see. And the Senate just held a vote on this whole issue of whether or not there should be... Yeah, I'm going to have to take these headphones off if you can't get rid of that echo. Held a vote on 29 votes yes for the funding of, with restrictions, the funding of the ongoing occupation of Iraq. 67 votes no. Interestingly enough, many of the Democratic candidates for president, like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama specifically, voted yes. They're among the 29 yeas. And some of the Republicans who had been speaking out, like, for example, Gordon Smith, voted no on this thing, along with a lot of Democrats. David Horowitz is on the line with us. He is the founder of the David Horowitz Foundation, the New Terrorism Project, the author of The Shadow Party, How George Soros, Hillary Clinton, and 60s Radicals Seized Control of the Democratic Party, shadowparty.com, the website. David Horowitz, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be back.
I don't hear an echo when I hear you. Just this is making me crazy. Anyhow, David, tell us, first of all, what's going on with this?
What's going on with this
vote? You're suggesting that... I am sorry, this echo is just so bad in my head. Chris, you've got to fix this. You are suggesting that terror on the... campuses that I'm really sorry when I hear myself after a second.
Okay, just give me a question. I'll run with it.
Yeah, David Horowitz, why do you want more of our students to be terrified? That seems like you're spreading terror on our campuses.
It's a good question. Look, I think that there is a lack of appreciation for how dangerous the situation is that we're in. Here we had a bunch of guys from the Albania, Kosovo region, training in the Poconos to kill 100 servicemen. Now that they were Al-Qaeda followers. We have such porous borders. They were overstayed visas. Nobody's checking. The only reason they were caught was because they videoed themselves training and brought it into a video store to be developed. And actually, the clerk was worried that they might be accused of discrimination if they reported them. But they didn't.
But David,
report
this
them.
Isn't the only one. I mean, they're all over the place. Down in Austin, Texas, just a couple of weeks ago, you had a guy who was caught. You know, within an hour, the bomb would have detonated. It would have killed a lot of people. I mean, it was just a massive thing.
Yeah,
the second largest terrorist incident in the United States was Tim McVeigh. I mean, these are Christian terrorists in the United States.
No, hold on a second. Look, this is ridiculous. You don't, you know...
No, it's not ridiculous.
Oh, it's totally ridiculous, and I wanted to...
What you're trying to do is foment fear and hatred of Muslims.
Look, if I say black people have no problems in this country because Oprah Winfrey is the richest woman in America, I have 100 leftists get up in the audience and say, you know, that's you can't prove the rule by the exception. Look,
and that's exactly what you're trying to do. You're trying to prove the rule by the exception. You've got some idiots out in California who put together an incompetent plan, and you want to run around and make it politically correct on campuses to have this be the only thing that's discussed.
We have a global religious movement, which includes, at the minimum, if only at the minimum, 150 million people, but more likely 500 million people, who want us dead and believe they will get to heaven if they kill us.
No, that's a massive, wild, outrageous overstatement, David Horowitz, and you know it. There are not hundreds of millions of people who want us dead.
Of course there are.
There are hundreds of millions of people who want us out of their country.
Tom,
they want us out of their country. David, if Canada and Mexico had invaded the United States, would you join me in taking up arms against them?
That's why they saw people's heads off.
If Canada and Mexico invaded the United States, would you join me in taking up arms against them?
If who invaded the United States?
Canada and Mexico.
We didn't invade anybody. The basic problem, this is what leftists don't understand. You guys are going to get beheaded first anyway. These people mean
what they... We should all be afraid, be very afraid.
Mean what they say. They've been saying it for decades. They are religious fanatics who believe that killing anybody, children, women, it doesn't matter, will get them to heaven. That's what they believe.
And
that's
why they're driving that behavior. We are their recruiters. Osama bin Laden had 20,000 followers, David. 20,000 followers Osama bin Laden had before George Bush turned him into a rock star.
Whether you take a poll from CNN or Al Jazeera, it's somewhere between 10% and 50% of Muslims think Osama bin Laden is a hero. That computes 10% would be 150 million people, 50% would be 750 million people. There's a lot of people abroad and in America who are lunatic religious fanatics.
You are absolutely right. You are absolutely right. And you are absolutely right that they're doing that because of this Republican war against Iraq and the ongoing occupation of it.
That's completely idiotic. They were chanting death to America in 1979.
People were chanting death to America in 1849 during the Spanish-American War. You're talking small incidents back then. It has become a large incident ever since this Republican war in Iraq.
You're completely wrong. There were a million people in Tehran chanting death to America when Jimmy Carter was president, and Jimmy Carter helped the Ayatollah to power. Jimmy Carter was the liberal president who said America was to blame. He did everything possible to get rid of the Shah and bring in the Ayatollah. And the first thing they did was to take Americans hostage. That was
so, David Horowitz, what do you want to do on college campuses with regard to this? Because this is the focus of your new terrorism project.
There's a large denial. Let's put it that way. It's more sinister than that because I believe that organizations like the Muslim Students Association support the terrorists, and they complain every time somebody uses a sentence in which the word Muslim and terrorist appears, that it somehow discriminates against them, and that amounts to...
So you want to impose your version of political correctness on campuses?
Political correctness, which is a party line, is a suppression of speech. Students have wanted to show the film Obsession.
Right. So you want to stop the Muslim Students Association?
I organized 100 campuses to show it. And I'm going to do a much bigger, I will organize many more campuses in the fall. This is a battle just to be able to say, this is our enemy, this is what they believe, and this is why they're so dangerous. And
David Horowitz, last night during...
their heads in the sand on this issue.
I understand.
It's not George Bush who created the terrorists. The terrorists were there. What George Bush did was protect us by taking the battle to the enemy camp.
Yeah, right. So the guys who 5 and 10 years ago in Iraq were welders and shopkeepers and taking tickets at movie theaters are now shooting at us because George Bush had nothing to do with anything, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, okay.
You're so wrong. Look, Muhammad Atta, was an urban planner and an architect. These guys, Ramzi Youssef, was an engineer.
Right, and if we had not occupied, if we didn't have soldiers in Saudi Arabia, these guys wouldn't have a beef with us.
Well,
we weren't totally addicted to oil over there because Ronald Reagan rejected Jimmy Carter's energy policies and said, no, we're going to stay addicted to oil because it's profitable for the campaign contributors to the Republican Party. They wouldn't give a damn about us.
The United States
why are they attacking us and not Sweden?
Because Saddam Hussein...
If they hate countries that are free, why aren't they bombing Sweden?
Why have me on if you don't want to hear what I have to say? I mean, is it so frightening?
Well, we've both been speaking, I think.
Put, the United States troops were in Saudi Arabia at the request of the Saudis because Saddam Hussein had just swallowed a whole country, Kuwait. Remember?
David, I want to continue this. Can you stick around for a few minutes?
Absolutely.
All right, great. Let's take a break here and we'll come back with David Horowitz because I'm curious about your take on the Republican discussion last night and what the end point is of your worldview on all of this. And I think it'll be fascinating. Then we'll get to our listeners. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
No, we just need to make sure that the Muslim Student Association doesn't have an opportunity to speak up. Right, David Horowitz?
Wrong.
Okay, all righty.
Muslim Students Association should stop. Well, they won't, but people should not allow them to stop discussion of the serious problem that radical Islam poses to the life and limbs of people in the West.
We're talking with David Horowitz, ShadowParty.com. His website, his new book, Shadow Party, How George Soros, Hillary Clinton, and 60s Radicals Seize Control of the Democratic Party. He's also put together, through the David Horowitz Foundation, the New Terrorism Project to carry the word of terrorism to our college campuses. David, last night, watching the Republican debate, it seemed to me that several of the chicken hawks there, I mean, John McCain significantly differentiated himself by saying that everybody in the Senate and the House who had served in the active military was opposed to the use of torture, and all of the people up on the podium there, except for him, it was like, oh, I'd torture them faster than the other guy would torture them. What's the end game here? Today, May 16th, 1918, was the day that Congress passed the Sedition Act. Eugene Debs gave a speech in Ohio, in Canton, Ohio, in June, shortly after this was passed. And he was arrested, tried, and sentenced to 10 years in prison under this law for simply standing up and saying that he didn't think that our participation in World War I was a good idea. Where, if your message of fear is really adopted and just grabbed hold of by many, many, many Americans right across the board, and the shutting down that the Republicans have been working on so aggressively of things like the Posse Comitatus Act that says that the military can't turn their guns on American citizens, and habeas corpus, which says that if you're arrested, you at least have access to due process and to face your accusers, and all, if the continuing evisceration of our civil liberties continues, and this continuing state of not just fear but panic, frankly, I think that you're promoting. What's the end game? Where can this lead other than to a fascistic state?
Well, you know, if you think the way you just outlined it, it can't. But the reality is this. First of all, let me say that the imprisonment of Debs was wrong. But times have also changed. We used to have big oceans that protected us and gave us a lot of latitude. It's better to be afraid.
Didn't stop us in the War of 1812. England came over and burned down the White House.
Jesus, come on. You're not really...
Well, there was an ocean, and it was England, and they were on the other side of the ocean, and they burned down the White House. That was more successful than Osama bin Laden.
You can compare 1812 to 9/11 fine. It's better to be afraid than to be dead. And, of course, there's a lot of bad faith here. The left, which is leading the charge, first of all, we haven't had our civil liberties eroded. Second of all, the people who are leading this charge don't believe in the American system. You know, the ACLU and all these organizations hate America. They're not interested in civil
liberties. Oh, come on. David, you're better than that. That's pathetic.
Samuel Aryan was...
You know these guys don't hate America. You know that they... I will at least give you, David, the credit. I will at least believe. And I'll say it right up front. You and the majority of the conservatives who come on this program that I argue with or debate or whatever, that I believe that you love this country and you have a vision of this country that you think is a positive vision. And I love this country and I have a vision of this country that I think is a positive vision. And we differ on what that vision may be or on how to accomplish it. But I think that most all of us love America. And to say that somebody hates America, I mean, I'm sorry, that's pathetic.
Really? You think the Vietnam...
Yes, I really do. I have never met anybody on the left who hates America.
You think Medea Benjamin and Noam Chomsky love America? Come on!
I know Medea Benjamin. Yes, Medea Benjamin's a friend of mine, and she loves America passionately.
Look, let's not argue this issue then. I think that Medea Benjamin and Noam Chomsky self-evidently hate this country. What they love is a country which they would fashion, which would look like Castro's Cuba. But they don't love this country. They don't want to protect this country.
Medea Benjamin has never said anything that would suggest that this country should be like Cuba.
You know, we have lost the major civil liberties that we have lost are standing in line and getting searched in airports, which I have to do. I have an artificial hip every time I go on an airplane, waiting in line, through security checks. That's a huge...
You're not concerned that the police can come into your home right now without a search warrant?
What?
And go through your papers? You don't think that that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment?
Going through my papers without a search warrant? What are you talking about?
You haven't read the Patriot Act? It's called sneak and peek. Police departments can come into your home, go through your papers without a search warrant, as long as you don't know that they were there.
I
that doesn't bother you.
What? I don't believe it, for one.
Read the Patriot Act.
It's like 1,000 pages. I will look it up. You can have me back on, but I don't believe that for a second. There's no American citizen...
Google sneak peek.
You know, if this was going on, given the ACLU is a very well-funded organization, there would be suits all over the place.
There are. There are people trying to stop the Patriot Act, or some of those provisions of the Patriot Act. You're not concerned that an American citizen like yourself can be arrested and...
I don't think they're arresting enough people.
Okay, we've hit the break.
Otherwise, those Pocono terrorists would not have been on the loose.
Yeah. David, thanks for coming on the program. David Horowitz, ShadowParty.com, the founder of the David Horowitz Foundation, the New Terrorism Project. David, thanks again. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
About our enemy. They say that when you see him, he looks just like you and me. But you deny it, Sergeant, and you are a man of war. So you must give me lessons, for I've never killed before. Now there are several lessons that I haven't mastered yet. I haven't got the hang of how to use a bayonet. If he doesn't die at once, am I to stick him with it more? Oh, I hope you will be patient, for I've never killed before.
You know, every political party has its truth tellers. I think it's just absolutely fascinating watching the Democratic and the Republican debates. Dennis Kucinich is the truth teller in the Democratic Party. He's the guy who says the things that everybody else finds uncomfortable. The things that really they'd rather weren't said in polite company. And Ron Paul is the truth teller in the Republican Party. And interestingly, last night, Ron Paul kept trying to bring the Republican Party and the Republican debates This is just to follow on to David Horowitz's suggestion that we should all be terrified and that people on college campuses should be the most terrified because that's the next generation of Americans, after all. Let's get them when they're young. Ron Paul trying to point out to the Republicans their own history. You will recall that prior to Richard Nixon being elected president, Republicans used to refer to those Democrat wars. This is like, you know, Joe McCarthy, one of his phrases, those Democrat wars, World War I, World War II, the Korean War, those Democrat wars, those wars that were done by the Democratic Party, because it was the Democratic Party that fought World War I. In fact, Woodrow Wilson, in my opinion, inappropriately pushed us into it. I'm still not convinced that the United States ever should have been involved in World War I. It dragged me off along with Eugene Debs, I guess. World War II we got into appropriately and, frankly, in my opinion, way too late. But you had Republican. One of the reasons why it took Franklin Roosevelt so long to get into World War II is because Republicans were constantly on the floor of the House and Senate complaining that they thought that Roosevelt wanted to secretly get us into a war because it would enhance the powers of the president. And, in fact, Rex Stout, the guy who invented the Nero Wolfe character, who at the time was the best-selling author in the world, over 80 million books of his were in print, the Nero Wolfe series, in 1945 or 46, published a book. You can still find used copies of it. It hasn't been in print since then, but you can find them on the used book sites, called The Illustrious Dunderheads, which is a collection of speeches, mostly by Republicans, there's a few Democrats in there, on the floor of the House and Senate in the years leading up to Pearl Harbor, in which they were saying, oh, everything's fine, Hitler's a good guy, we should just leave Europe alone, don't worry. Oh, France fell, so what? There goes Holland, no big deal. Ah, Norway, we didn't care about the Norwegians, it's not our problem, we shouldn't be involved. That was the historic Republican position. And Ron Paul last night talking about it.
I think the party has lost its way because the conservative wing of the Republican Party always advocated a non-interventionist foreign policy. Senator Robert Taft didn't want to be in NATO.
That's Senator Robert Taft of Ohio.
George Bush won the election in year 2000 campaigning on a humble foreign policy. No nation building, no policing of the world.
And in fact, he did. I mean, that was in 2000, one of Bush's central campaign tenets was that when Clinton went into the Balkans, he shouldn't have done that. We shouldn't be involved in nation building.
Republicans were elected to end the Korean War. The Republicans were elected to end the Vietnam War.
And that is just so absolutely spot on. In fact, if you go back and you listen to Dwight Eisenhower's campaign ads in 1952, when Dwight Eisenhower was running and for president, it was on the campaign of vote for peace to end the Korean War. Here's the ad from Dwight Eisenhower.
Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians. He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. He elects the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Vote for peace. Vote for a Republican. Right? Vote for Eisenhower. That used to be the party. Ron Paul talking about that last night. Nobody wanted to hear it. He continued.
There's a strong tradition of being anti-war in the Republican Party. It is the constitutional position. It is the advice of the founders to follow a non-interventionist foreign policy. Stay out of entangling alliances. Be friends with countries. Negotiate and talk with them and trade with them. Just think of the tremendous improvement relationship with Vietnam. We lost 60,000 men. We came home in defeat. Now we go over there and invest in Vietnam. So there's a lot of merit to the advice of the founders and following the Constitution. And my argument is that we shouldn't go to war so carelessly. When we do, the wars don't end.
And all after that, all of the Republicans basically had that deer in headlights look, and nobody wanted to say, oh no, we're all in favor of wars. But they are. Well, I'll share some more clips with you as we go through the program today. 1-866-303-2270 is our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, or go to AirAmerica.com and click on the Tom Hartman Show link. It'll take you to a page where you'll find a link to our chat room. And by the way, today I will be, or tomorrow, today I'm flying to Denver, and tomorrow I'll be doing the show live in Denver from the Boulder Theater. Should be great fun. And you can find out all about it at am760.net. Check that out. And then, of course, over the Friday, we'll be doing the show from KTRC in Santa Fe, and on Saturday at the Greer Garson Theater at 2 o'clock. I'm looking forward to that. We're going to have a great time. Jeff in San Francisco, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Oh, you know, David Horowitz, he just... He makes me very ill. He's
one of the major voices on the right. He is one of the most visible and most powerful forces on the right.
I know, and you know, but what I think he does is he really just has a tendency of just using emotional arguments, us versus them arguments, and he has kind of a history of telling some falsehoods. I mean, one of the ones we all remember was the New York Times debacle over publishing satellite photos of Cheney's summer home, and he published an article on frontpagemag.com on June 30th. You can find it, where he accused, I think, the New York Times of more or less wanting to kill the vice president. Turned out that the Cheney's press office had released this satellite photo themselves, and this was public knowledge. And, of course, you can find it on Google.
Well, I would say that's not so much an example of him being intentionally deceptive as him being reflexively hysterical.
But
in any case, David isn't here to defend himself, and so I don't want to get into trying to psychoanalyze him or attacking him. But your point is well taken that many of these arguments appeal just to simple base emotions, and we've seen that movie before. We've seen it in other countries. We've seen it in this country, frankly, in 1918 on this day in history when the Sedition Act was passed. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I was hoping that you would challenge him on his comment that he made about Carter and him empowering the Ayatollah when Reagan and Bush the first were in communication with the Tehran regime during the hostage crisis.
Sure.
And then, voila, they released the hostage
Casey,
during Reagan's inauguration. A lot of people don't remember that. And we've got
what amazes me is how many people think, you know, for example, yesterday in the eulogies to Jerry Falwell, I was on several occasions on network television, more than one commentator said that Jerry Falwell delivering the Christian vote in 1980 was what got Ronald Reagan elected. And the fact of the matter is that 6 weeks before the election, Jimmy Carter was way ahead of Ronald Reagan. Jimmy Carter had been way ahead of Ronald Reagan and George Bush throughout that election cycle.
Definitely.
And it looked like Carter was going to win that thing hands down, Christian vote or no Christian vote. And what killed Carter in the last 5 weeks of the election was the fact that he was unable to get those hostages freed. Many people believe, because as Barbara Honegger wrote in her book, October Surprise, and I believe, was it Gary Sick or Gary North? I forget my Garys. One of them wrote also a book by the same title, October Surprise, pointing out that Bill Casey and George Bush had cut this deal with the Ayatollahs to keep the hostages, and that's why Ronald Reagan won. Reagan won because of the hostages in Iran, period. I mean, it's any rational student of history will tell you that.
Thanks for everything, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome, David. And thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Brian in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Brian.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Just a quick comment on your guest there, Mr. Horowitz. To me, it seems like such an anachronism really would fit better in the days of the Crusades and sweeping vilifications of the need to go into those areas and control the Holy Lands and stuff like that, and to wipe out the threat that is the, you know, the Muslim nation.
That's the other question that I really should have asked him and didn't get to, and perhaps we'll have him back. And that is, you know, what do you want? How many people do you have to kill? How many? If there's 100 million people who are willing to go in the streets and chant "Death to America," do we kill all of them? You kill 100 million? Does that mean then? I mean, there's 6 billion people in the world. There's about 1 billion Muslims. Does that mean now you're going to have 200 million against you? You kill all of them? What? We're using, you know, industrial sized nukes.
Well,
we have 400 million people who hate you. I mean, what's the end game of this is crazy.
And consider this, what I think, you know, what happened in Central America during Reagan and stuff like that was, you know, all those, you know, people killed, families killed.
Yeah.
What restraint those people have had not to exact revenge. So
you're,
I don't think...
You're right.
You know.
Yeah, and it's the same thing in South Africa. I mean, the idea of reconciliation is a good and healthy one, and that's just definitely not the road we're going down here. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Born in Virginia in 33, he could spot a homosexual behind every tree. One thing came through consistently. He was much better than either you or me. Jerry Falwell, at least he wasn't queer, supposedly. He knew 9/11 wasn't what it seemed. It wasn't Al-Qaeda that got us creamed. It was just God sending down a little sign that gay marriage and abortion are a little out of line. Jerry Falwell looked like he drank a lot of beer, even if he probably didn't. And let's not forget that Teletubby kid. There was something sort of gay about everything he did. Thank God for Jerry for making us aware. Sometimes it's hard to see what's right there. Jerry Falwell watched too much TV, or with the sound off or something. And not to be outdone, he outdid himself. The king of wacko title ain't for nobody else. Global warming, he said, really ain't the point. It's just Satan's way of getting you a little out of joint. Jerry Falwell, let's all shed a little tear.
Indeed, and we will be talking about that a little more in the third hour of our program. Welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour. Byron in Montana, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I hear you. I like that line, too. I use it out here all the time. I'm a truck driver. Whenever a waitress asks me, I said, I'm doing fine, but I'll get better. I love that. I stole it from you. Yeah. I'm 55 years old. I'm a truck driver, and I remember David Horowitz back in the 70s as a virulent left-winger, and anybody who changes goes from, you know, one real extreme to the other, I don't trust to begin with. And when you brought up the subject that, or the fact that the Patriot Act and the police can come in your house and everything, and he poo-pooed it, I mean, how can somebody be so stupid? But you didn't bring up the fact that also in that law is nobody can say anything about it. I mean, the librarians can't tell anybody if they come in and check your records. I mean, if somebody comes in your house, it's against the law for you to even say anything about it. So how's the ACLU going to find out? Because if you tell somebody, you've broken a law.
Yeah, I know. It's incredible. And with regard to your point about people changing their affiliation, as it were, over the years, not necessarily specifically talking to David, but your point, Byron, is really well taken. And I would submit to you, again, I don't want to try and psychoanalyze David Horowitz, particularly when he's not here to defend himself, but there are a number of people who wear as a proud badge, particularly when they go on Fox News, that they used to be liberals. And now they're conservatives. And I would submit that those people actually never were liberals. That they might have taken positions that they consider to be, quote, left. But that the real difference between liberals and conservatives has to do with the fundamental idea, the fundamental difference in worldview. That conservatives, by and large, live in a state of fear and believe that the world is a dangerous place. And it's a dangerous place because people are essentially evil. They believe in original sin. They believe that people are essentially evil. They agree with Thomas Hobbes that before we had the iron fist of church or state or the institutions, other institutions of governance like corporations, before we had the iron fist of those institutions, that the natural state of man was to live without arts, without letters, without science, and that life was nasty, brutish, and short. And I'm paraphrasing badly, but it's close to that. And that was Hobbes' view in the 1630s. And then in the 1670s came along John Locke and said, no. And Rousseau and ultimately Jefferson and the founders of this country, they said, no, the essential nature, the original liberals, They said, no, the true nature of humans is to be good and decent. And the purpose of government isn't to suppress their evil impulses, although we do have to do that for some people who are dysfunctional. There are sociopaths and nutcases among us, but it's not the norm. They're the exception that proves the rule, not the other way around. The purpose of government is to backstop us. The purpose of government is to help us all achieve our highest potential, to make sure that we have the things that we need to be able to be successful and have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Things like roads and police departments and fire departments and public education and functionally a government that works with us and for us. And I would suggest, you know, national health care as well. And so, frankly, I think that there are a number of people who took, quote, left positions back in the 60s and 70s, but they did it out of fear. And they did it out of an essential belief that, you know, it was kind of a Stalinist left position. Joe Stalin was not a liberal. He was not even a leftist. He was a conservative. I mean, his worldview was the essential conservative worldview. On the other hand, you had Franklin Roosevelt. His worldview was the essential liberal worldview. And frankly, I can point out weaknesses in both. For example, Roosevelt believed Stalin at Yalta, thought that he was telling the truth, and Stalin, you know, wasn't. And the history, I think, has judged Roosevelt poorly for that, and probably appropriately so. So liberals have to be a little more suspicious, probably, and conservatives need to take a deep breath and relax. Paul in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Tom. Good show. I hate to sort of beat this Horowitz thing to death, but I was really kind of surprised when he said, or not surprised at all, I should say, when he said, you know, it's better to be alive than, it's better to be alive and afraid than dead. And that sort of contrasts pretty sharply with, you know, the Patrick Henry idea, give me liberty or give me death, the idea, give me creeping cowardice, but give me life.
Right. Yeah, that's a good restatement of it. And in fact, thank you for the reminder of the Patrick Henry quote. It's a very good one. Sandra in Berkeley, California. Hey, Sandra.
Hey, Tom. It's good to talk to you again. It seems to me it's funny that your guest was on was talking about that he thinks that liberals are un-American because one of the reasons that I called you is I was going to say that I feel like the people that are running this country right now, especially George Bush and Karl Rove, must hate this country. And I'm only saying that because of what they're doing. I don't want to feel like that. You know?
Well, I don't think that they hate this country either. I think that these are people who believe that the greatness of a nation is determined by the power of its wealthy families and institutions, and they are those wealthy families and institutions. And they frankly think of this, you know, they think that we should have, and they want to institute a new aristocracy, and they see themselves as the aristocrats. I think they love America. I don't think that they understand the foundations on which this country was founded. I just don't think that they get it. Or if they do get it, they don't like that, let's say. But that doesn't mean that, you know, frankly, I don't think that they hate America. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. The FDA stymied and pushed to boost safety of produce. This really follows on everything else we've been talking about. I want to get back to David Horowitz's point that we should all be very afraid of the terrorists, because that was basically the theme of last night's Republican debates. We're going to continue discussing the Republican debates. I do want to mention Jerry Falwell. We'll probably get to that in the third hour of the program. But this is just an example of this broad worldview that you find on the conservative side. On the first hand, the conservative worldview is motivated by fear and mistrust because it essentially assumes that all people are evil. And therefore, you know, they're out to get you, they're out to, you know, et cetera. Kill them before they kill you is the ultimate logic of this. And this is the logic that is being used increasingly among conservatives. By the way, Democratic conservatives as well as Republican conservatives. And it's a logic that, frankly, with very few exceptions, doesn't work, as we're seeing. I mean, if David Horowitz talking about how, you know, all these Muslims hate us all over the world. Gee, I wonder why. Which is the point that Ron Paul was trying to make in the debate last night. And he was pointing this out. And in fact, here's just a quick clip of Ron Paul in the debate last night. The congressman, Ron Paul is the congressman from Texas. He is the ultimate conservative Republican in that he actually calls himself a libertarian more often than not. He ran for president on the libertarian ticket some years ago. And as you know, I refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid because they're basically Republicans who believe that drugs should be decriminalized and prostitution should be decriminalized. And because of those latter two positions, or basically that all consensual behavior between adults should be decriminalized, because of those latter positions, a lot of people think that they're liberals or something like that. No, libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. And here is Ron Paul, a Republican libertarian last night. But he also is at least a principled libertarian. I mean, this is I do have considerable respect for, even though I strongly disagree with their worldview and their point of view. I do have a considerable respect for those Republicans and conservatives and libertarians who actually understand their own philosophy, believe it to be true, and act consistently on it. And Ron Paul is one of the few, frankly, who is willing to do so.
You have to realize that the base of the Republican Party shrunk last year because of the war issue. So that percentage represents less people. If you look at 65 to 70% of the American people, they want us out of there. They want the war over.
Now, Ron Paul in this is responding to a question from the moderator, one of the faux news guys, saying basically, you're one of only a handful of Republicans in the United States House of Representatives who voted against the 2002 authorization for George Bush to have war powers. And Ron Paul was like, yeah, you know, if you're going to have war, you have war. You don't just, you know, do it like Korea and Vietnam. Let's have a little police action here. But the question embedded in the question was, are you representing the right party? You know, are you sure you should even be Republican? And he continued.
In 2002, I offered an amendment to international relations to declare war up or down. And it was nobody voted for the war. And my argument there was, if we want to go to war, and if we should go to war, the Congress should declare it. We don't go to war like we did in Vietnam and Korea because the wars never end. And I argued the case and made the point that it would be a quagmire if we go in. Ronald Reagan in 1983 sent Marines into Lebanon.
Now, at this point, everybody in the room is cringing because they know that where this story is going. Reagan sent the Marines in. The Marines got killed. Reagan cut and run and pulled them out. Right? And Ron Paul turns it actually into a heroic story for the Republicans, and they should use it. Because they try to pretend that it didn't happen.
And he said he would never turn tail and run. A few months later, the Marines were killed, 241 were killed, and the Marines were taken out. And Reagan addressed this subject in his memoirs. And he says, I said I would never turn tail and run. He says, but I never realized the irrationality of Middle Eastern politics, and he changed his policy there. We need the courage of a Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, we need the courage of a Ronald Reagan. And that's Ron Paul saying, you know, we need the courage of a Ronald Reagan to pull out. Interesting. So, anyhow, here's this conservative worldview right across the board. If you're a conservative and you believe that the purpose of government is to protect people from themselves, because people themselves are essentially evil. If you're a conservative and you believe that the purpose of government is to protect people from themselves and from other evil people, then of course you want an army to protect you from other evil people, and conservatives want police forces and strong and muscular police forces to protect us from ourselves. And that's it. That's basically it. I mean, Ron Paul said that last night. That the only purpose of government, the purposes of government should be limited to government in its protective fashion, in its protective capacity. And this is the libertarian position, it's the conservative Republican position, and the government therefore should not be involved in any other part of our lives, such as making sure that our food supply is safe. Government shouldn't be doing that. Government shouldn't be, you know, because, you know, the food supply, that's neutral. That's not just people. Well, you could argue that there's nasty people who will sell wrong things. Well, then you let the free market figure it out, or you prosecute them for fraud. But, you know, checking food, preventing harm before it happens, that shouldn't be a function of government. That's the conservative worldview. Making sure that drugs are safe, making sure that that people are well educated, offering education, offering health care. None of those things in the conservative mind, in the conservative worldview, none of those things should happen. The entire New Deal in the conservative mindset should be rolled back, because after all, Roosevelt is dead, you know.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And here's another example of this. This in today's Wall Street Journal. The Food and Drug Administration, under fire for a string of illnesses caused by contaminated vegetables, early this year came up with an ambitious industry-endorsed plan calling for tough new regulations on the handling of fresh produce. You get this? Now, the FDA, whose job is to make sure that the food is pure, the Food and Drug Administration is pure, says, okay, we're going to put together some regulations. And a lot of people in industry said, okay, fine. You come in and inspect our stuff. We would appreciate that. You know, it's a fine thing. But back to the article by Jane Zhang in today's Wall Street Journal, second paragraph. But the plan went nowhere after it got a cold reception from the FDA's parent agency, the Department of Health and Human Services. And even today, amid continuing concern about the safety of the nation's food supply, efforts to address the problem remain in limbo. At the meeting, the FDA warned that its current approach, now this is where we're at right now, its current approach to protecting the safety of fruits and vegetables, which relies on the industry following voluntary guidelines, was failing to stop an increase in foodborne illness. George W. Bush, when he was governor of Texas, said, yeah, let's have higher standards, stronger standards for emissions from chemical factories and petroleum factories. Let's get all kinds of publicity for saying that we're going to clean up the air. And let's make those standards voluntary. So you say, yes, we're going to do something. We have these new high thresholds, but it's voluntary. And the result, Texas got some of the worst air in the country, and some of the most polluted places in the entire United States are in Texas. The Wall Street Journal notes, under the Clinton administration, the FDA imposed rules requiring the seafood and juice industries to take steps to prevent contamination. But in 2004, as the number of foodborne illnesses grew, the FDA wrote a voluntary action plan for the produce industry. Lester Crawford, the former FDA commissioner, said the administration, the Bush administration, Republicans, essentially, have been reluctant to make something mandatory until you can prove that it will do something good. You can't prove it'll do something good until you do it. It's a catch-22. So, the bottom line for the conservative worldview, if it has to do with improving the quality of life in the United States, if it has to do with improving the quality of life anywhere in the world for that matter, you know, foreign aid programs, don't do it. That's not a function of government. That should be left to the nobility. That should be Barbara Bush giving a $30,000 donation to Katrina victims, as long as it goes to her son Neil, who owns a program that's making money under the No Child Left Behind program. That's how social services should be done. But when it comes to protecting the homeland, when it comes to keeping us safe, let's kill all the malefactors and nuke the terrorists.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Conservative Christian, right wing Republican, straight white American males. to the quail. Quite diligently, working so hard to keep the free brains of this democracy. From tree hugging, peace loving, pot smoking, barefoot, and folk singing hippies like me.
Looks like Paul Wolfowitz is on his way out. That's the speculation. World Bank officials, this is from ABC News, World Bank officials say the bank's board is completing an exit strategy that will allow World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz to resign this afternoon and still save some face over the issue of his efforts to seek a promotion and pay raise for his girlfriend at the bank. What I'm really curious about, and I have a feeling that the real story of this will probably come out in the months following Wolfowitz's departure, is there's three issues here. There's Wolfowitz and his girlfriend. You know, on its face, bad behavior, but it's sort of like Clinton and Monica. Is it really enough to remove him from the head of the World Bank? And frankly, I'm skeptical. I think it's being used as an excuse. Number two, you've got Wolfowitz promoting. You've got Wolfowitz being punished for having been one of the lead architects of the Iraq War. I think that there's a lot of people in the World Bank who hate his guts because of that. And that probably has a lot to do with why he's being pushed out. And those are the two areas of speculation in the press. The third one that I find most interesting gets back to our conversation of this entire morning, or afternoon, or wherever, whatever it may be, wherever you are, the first hour and a half of our program here today. And that is that Wolfowitz is also, you know, one of the neocon architects of the entire concept that, for example, I mean, this ties back to Iraq, but in his mind, I'm sure, goes way beyond that. That structural adjustment is the phrase that they use at the World Bank, should be imposed on countries as a precondition for getting loans. In other words, countries should be forced to privatize their social security systems, to do away with national health care systems. I mean, there's a whole spectrum of things that, you know, sometimes are forced, sometimes they're just recommended, sometimes they're just hinted at, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, or whatever. And there's no shortage of books about this. John Perkins doing a great job of writing on this stuff these days, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman Guy. And this whole neocon idea that government should not be a function of we the people, that government should restrain we the people, that if people want to have a strong social security system, if they want to have national health care, if they want to have elder care, if they want to have a good public education system, if they want to have free public colleges and universities, if they want to have good trade schools that are free for their students so that they can have a good, strong, educated workforce, none of that should be the business of government. That's the Wolfowitz worldview. And I'm really curious to know whether that might be one of the reasons why he's being forced out of the World Bank, or whether most of the people in the World Bank agree with him on that. Or whether there's a schism developing in the World Bank now around this issue. I'm just speculating here, but I in other words, is the World Bank becoming more liberal and less conservative? Or not? Who knows? We'll see. We found out now that the person who personally intervened to, as the great folks at the Center for American Progress say over at the thinkprogress.org blog, kneecap Comey, the guy who was the acting attorney general when John Ashcroft had his pancreatitis and was in the hospital, the guy who personally intervened to send his lawyer, Gonzalez, and his chief of staff, Andy Card, over to the hospital to try and get John Ashcroft to sign off on an illegal wiretapping program against American citizens in violation of the Fourth Amendment and in violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, was George W. Bush. And Comey's testimony before John Conyers' committee, this is in and of itself, in my opinion, an impeachable act. Here you have the President of the United States having his lawyer and his chief of staff confront an ill attorney general and essentially force the guy to go along, although he didn't. He refused to do it. And Comey refused to do it, but eventually, you know, 3 weeks later, after George Bush called him into his office and personally dressed him down, Comey then did it. Signing off on, yes, the Justice Department will break the law on your behalf, Mr. Bush. How is this different from the Justice Department will spy on Democrats on your behalf, yes, Mr. Nixon? One of the things that Nixon was impeached for. How is it different? I guess the only thing missing from it is that we don't know who the people who were being spied on were. And that's why 2 years ago I wrote an op-ed piece for Common Dreams and you know, it showed up all over the blogosphere, suggesting that the Democrats should stop talking about the Republican, the spy program and the illegal wiretap program and start calling it the Spy on Democrats program. Because for all we know, and you might as well just say it right up front, and let them deny it, because they haven't denied it. For all we know, most of the people that Bush wanted to be illegally wiretapping were Democrats. I mean, was this directed toward Ted Kennedy? There's no evidence it wasn't. 866-303-2270, our number, 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Although things are moving in the right direction, I think. This vote this morning, even though it didn't pass, was a good start. This was really a good start. And in fact, I would like to call out and say congratulations. Well done. Our jolly good fellow alert here. To the senators who voted, the Democratic senators who voted yes on this Iraq resolution that had a specific cutoff date on it. Akaka, Biden, Boxer, Byrd, Cantwell, Cardin, Clinton, Dodd, Durbin, Feingold, Feinstein, Harkin, Inouye, Kennedy, Kerry, Klobuchar, Cole, Lautenberg, Leahy, Menendez, Mikulski, Murray, Obama, Reid, Bernie Sanders, Schumer, Stabenow, Whitehouse, and Wyden. Good on you. And now the other Democrats, like Baucus of Montana and Bayh of Indiana and Bingaman of New Mexico and Carper of Delaware and Casey of Pennsylvania and Conrad of North Dakota, where were you guys? Dorgan of North Dakota. I mean, you expect Republicans like Pete Domenici to vote, you know, no for this because they just, you know, they're gung-ho for the Republican war and Republican occupation. But Byron Dorgan? I'm baffled. Mary Landrieu, from Louisiana, Carl Levin from Michigan, Lieberman, the independent from Kennewell, of course, Lincoln, the from Arkansas, Claire McCaskill from Missouri, Nelson, these all voted no. Nelson from Florida, Nelson from Nebraska, Pryor, Reed, Harry Reid voted against this thing, Rockefeller, Jay Salazar from Colorado, voted against it. Tester from Montana voted against it. And Webb from Virginia voted against it. And so, you know, where were you guys? Anyhow, it's a start. It's a start. Those who served versus those who didn't. Those who understand the military versus those who don't. Those who didn't serve in the military, who never saw armed combat in their lives, who've never seen anybody shot up close unless they happened to be around Dick Cheney when he was on a hunting party. Mitt Romney, for example, last night.
He said the person's going to be in Guantanamo. I'm glad they're at Guantanamo. I don't want them on our soil. I want them in Guantanamo when they don't get the access to lawyers they get without our soil. I don't want them in our prisons. I want them there. Some people have said we ought to close Guantanamo. My view is we had a double Guantanamo.
Yeah, let's just lock people up for years at a time in solitary confinement, torture them, and subject them to physical and psychological abuse, and don't even charge them with a crime. That's the American way. At least that's Mitt Romney's American way. Rudy Giuliani, another guy who never saw combat, never saw somebody die in combat, never served in the armed forces.
In the hypothetical that you gave me, which assumes that we know there's going to be another attack and these people know about it, I would tell the people who had to do the interrogation to use every method they could think of. Shouldn't be tortured, but every method they can think of. I'd say every method they could think of, and I would support them in doing that because I've seen what.
And the Republicans just loved it.
When you make a mistake about this, and I don't want to see another 3,000 people dead.
Yeah, and as if torturing would have gotten the information, all we had to do was have the FBI. Say, you know, be paid attention to. All we had to do was have George Bush pay attention to the 56 memos he got saying Bin Laden's coming to get you, do something about it, and maybe send out a notice to all the FBI offices saying, any of you guys know anything about anything going on? And then maybe Colleen Raleigh would have come forward, well, she tried to, maybe he would have listened to her. But in any case, so then John McCain speaks up, the only guy who actually served in combat on that panel, and the guy who has firsthand knowledge of torture, and John McCain actually had something very positive to say, in my opinion.
The interesting thing about that aspect is that during the debate when we did the Detainee Treatment Act, there was a sharp division between those who had served in the military and those who hadn't. Virtually every senior officer, retired or active duty, starting with Colin Powell, General Vesey, and everyone else, agreed with my position that we should not torture people. One of their reasons is because if we do it, what happens to our military people when they're captured? And also they realize there's more to war than the battlefield. So yes, literally every retired military person, an active duty military person who has actually been in battle and served for extended times in the military, supported my position, and I'm glad of it.
And once again, all the other Republicans on the stage had the deer in headlights look like they do when Ron Paul spoke up. And we just want to fearmonger, you know, fearmongering's the way to do it. It's just, you know, make people afraid and then they'll vote for you. They'll follow you anywhere. I mean, isn't that what Goebbels said? Yeah, right. Len in New York City. Hey, Len.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I was looking at the Fox News poll that they did for the debate, and Mitt Romney came in first at 29%. I would attribute that to his hair. But Ron Paul came in second at 25%. And, you know, that's the one thing that they will not acknowledge, that there's a quarter of the population there that actually is thinking intelligently and isn't just following the mantra. At the same time, though, Rush Limbaugh and there was a woman on from the Washington Times this morning on C-SPAN are both suggesting that, you know, this is all fringe stuff, this Ron Paul. You know, we really can't go down the road that he's talking about.
Yeah, just like Dennis Kucinich's fringe stuff in the Democratic Party. I mean, they're the same voices. They're the giant establishment voices saying, oh, we really don't want these truth tellers to have a public forum. I am so grateful that Dennis Kucinich has run for president the last two times, because he, even though he has not gained the national mojo or whatever, you know, he hasn't ended up the candidate and probably won't this time. Nonetheless, his presence there is causing truths to be spoken that need to be said. He is speaking truth to power. And I think that whether Dennis Kucinich wins or not, whether Ron Paul wins or not, and I think it would make a hell of a matchup. Dennis Kucinich on the Democratic side, Ron Paul on the Republican side. Then you could have a Lincoln-Douglas debate. Then you could have a genuine, honest debate on the issues. Two people who have integrity and actually believe what they're saying and are not doing it just to suck up to corporate interests or political interests. Ain't going to happen. But I think it's so important that both parties have these truth tellers in their parties. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe.
Well, yes. Actually, about at least a week and a half ago, Ron Paul is actually supposed to be excluded from tonight's debate. And they were going to use the excuse, well, he's just a minor candidate. So I don't think these political parties, I don't think they deserve the right to say who's going to be in these debates or not, because they're obviously, they can't accept responsibility. They're irresponsible. But the fact is, of course, they don't want Ron Paul to get anywhere. Hell, he's in Aaron Russo's movie. I mean, and Rush Limbaugh is talking about, well, he sounds like a liberal. No, he sounds like a libertarian because that's what he is, and they don't want that kind of viewpoint in these debates. It makes these Republicans sound ridiculous, and they don't.
Well,
and that's
the problem. They intrinsically are ridiculous. But well said, Joe. Thank you very much, Jerry in the Bronx, New York. Hey, Jerry.
Hello. Yeah.
It's not. I've been ever since I was a little kid. I've been saying the Bronx and the Queens, and it ain't. It's Bronx and Queens, right?
Well, we say the Bronx, but I guess originally it was named after Jonas Bronx, so you could say Bronx.
I mean, I grew up in Michigan, so I don't know from, but it's how I always used to say it, and then I've had people correct me. But anyway.
Well, I wanted to make a point about the David Horowitz. He happened to say, well, he's pointing out that before Iraq, the Iranians were chanting death to America, even though Jimmy Carter opposed the Shah. But that's all wrong. Carter was the ally of the Shah. He was supplying him. He was sending him weapons. And when the Shah fled from Iran, Carter gave him refuge here.
Right.
The Islamic militants there even said, they said to Carter, if you return the Shah to us, we'll release your hostages and forget it. And let bygones be bygones. See, this is the distortion involved here.
No, you're spot on, Jerry. And that's the problem in some of these debates, is that you get somebody who strings together a series of four or five misstatements. And you'll see this a lot, in the talking heads, particularly on Faux News, where they'll string together a series of four or five misstatements, and then you try to reply to it, and it's like, which one are you going to reply to? And the only alternative is to interrupt them mid-sentence every single time they do it, which is what I ended up doing with Horowitz, and then it sounds like you're being incredibly impolite. But wait a minute, you can't predicate a statement or a question on a predicate that is in and of itself wrong. Pete in New Haven, Connecticut. Hey, Pete, we've got about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Hello, hi. I was going to make a point about Iran, but I'd like to say that I went to, I grew up with Dave Horowitz in Sunnyside in Queens, and we both of us came from red diaper baby families, and our families knew each other, and he's always had a totalitarian mindset. He just moved it from old left to new left to neocon. But that's not the point I wanted to make. Iran has not been involved, has not attacked another country since 1738, when it invaded India. And the Iranians, I mean, that they have a lousy regime, but they always make that point.
Well, it's the attack by proxy, the fact that they're supporting Hezbollah. That's the thing that's got under everybody's skin. But your point is well taken, Pete. But and thanks for the call. But 1738, huh? That's interesting. When they very interesting. But still, it's if you're the Iranian support and this, well, actually, I guess it's the Syrian support as much as well. It's a big concern. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
You're in. The president kicked democracy out the door, and he shipped it off to a foreign shore, giving birth instead to a holy war. I don't know why those Iraqis got so sore. We only killed 100,000 or more. It's called collateral damage when you're waging a war. Bringing democracy back
because that's our job, to return the return democracy to this democratic republic, to bring back the will of the people in the United States of America. And what a fine and flattering thing it is when somebody writes a song that incorporates your tagline into it. That's great. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling this, I called a couple days ago to address Horowitz. I'm so not afraid. But
good.
With that, I had called in about complaining about the RICO laws and if the current administration could be charged under it. And you
right.
said yes. I have a complaint form from the Attorney General. And it's. I was wondering if you could help me. Or I know they have stolen money, but could you direct me or offer me something I could write that says, please briefly describe your complaint below. And it says attach additional documentation if necessary. Is there anything that you could do to help me in with this?
Wow. That's interesting that you're you know, willing and able to go out and do that. The definitions, the RICO Act specifically involves any act or threat involving gambling, murder, kidnapping, arson, robbery, bribery, or extortion.
Okay. And
what?
Do I have to specifically address each charge? I mean, stealing and bribery and, I mean, how does it, the stealing money and how
yeah,
do you address
excuse
something
Excuse me
like
a
that?
Second, Dave. Chris, your mixed minus is screwed up again. I'm hearing all kinds of audio in my headphones. It's overwhelming, Dave. I'm sorry. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know. I know stealing and robbery and, like, I don't know. How does that, do I have to address each charge directly?
I'm not an attorney, Dave. I so I can't give you specific advice on that. What you might want to do is, as a starting point, is
yes.
just go to Wikipedia.org. There's a really good analysis of the RICO laws there.
Yes.
You know where it came from, how it's done, how it's followed through on, and I would suggest starting there. And you know maybe you could find an attorney, you know somebody who'd be willing to work with you on it. But I'm sorry, you're outside of my realm of expertise in terms of how to fill out government forms on things like that. But I congratulate you for your enthusiasm for it and for following through on it. Darren in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Darren.
Hey there, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great here in the Republic of Little Beirut, as George Bush used to call it, where you and I live.
Well, we're
What's
proud
up?
To have you as a fellow Oregonian. Welcome to the club.
Thank you.
My comment, by the way, I'd like to, you know, comment on the previous listener. That whole RICO Act, I think, is brilliant. In regards to that, it's fruitless to try and go after impeachment at this point.
Yeah, I think that the RICO Act should be brought against not Bush, but against the Republican Party. Frankly,
amen.
My take on it. But
cheers to that. My question and comment, I'd just like to hear your opinion. I do believe that this whole Wolfowitz thing with the World Bank, they're trying to pin him on what could be a minutia. But there's a bigger picture. There's a stronger undercurrent that's happening there, the reason why the rest of the world community is trying to force him out. And if it's just based on $60,000, that doesn't really seem to be a very reasonable...
No, I agree with you, Darren. In fact, let's get Victoria Jones in here on this and get her thoughts on it. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
I'm sorry I didn't realize you were there. We were having a little bit of an audio problem. But anyhow, it looks like Wolfowitz is leaving.
Well, yes.
Why?
Because he's a very bad man.
Well done. Well said.
it looks as though he's leaving because it was very interesting in yesterday morning's gaggle to hear Tony Snow give his support for him, or at least to give the administration support for him, because he said how much they supported him. But then they went on to talk about what was best for the institution. And that gave the first indication that the two things might not be the same. So you got the impression that they were backing off ever so slightly. He then denied that when he was asked a question by the New York Times about whether they were in fact backing off. But the word was already out there.
Yeah.
I think that they realize that the situation is untenable and that he's unsupportable.
Well, and I'm wondering why. I think that the thing. Well, I think the thing with his girlfriend is sort of like Bill Clinton and Monica. It's an excuse for something larger. The Republicans wanted to basically disempower and destroy Bill Clinton. And I think that there's people who want to disempower and destroy Paul Wolfowitz. And I'm curious whether it's A, because he's the primary architect of the Iraq war and the whole neocon agenda.
Oh, I thought you mean why does the World Bank want to get rid of him? I thought why does the administration want to get rid of him?
Or whether it's B, because he's pursuing neoconservative economic policies, and the World Bank is actually starting to change its tune, and they don't want to impose structural adjustment on countries and things like that.
I think with the World Bank, it's all of the above. The World Bank is furious that he's an architect of the Iraq war. They genuinely oppose the Iraq war. They don't like the neocon policies. Even though he is fighting corruption, they think that his own corruption is frankly more corrupt than the corruption.
Right, his fighting corruption is sort of like Bill Clinton arguing in favor of fidelity laws or something like
that. Exactly, if he had been doing, which of course he wasn't, so there was a slight difference there. And so they want him gone. He also, when he came in, brought in a lot of neocons with him, neocons who alienated everybody and who went over everybody's heads and behaved towards the career employees of the World Bank with disdain.
These guys thought they were kings of the universe, masters of the universe.
That's how it appears.
Yeah, right across the board. Amazing. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. Coming up next, we're going to be talking our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment about everything you didn't know about the founding of this country. 57 minutes past here.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
And welcome back. You know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you know what you don't know, sometimes you're not sure that you know what you know, sometimes you don't even know what you don't know that you don't know. And sometimes, as the Firesign Theater so brilliantly reminded us, everything you know is wrong, right?
Know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could be Nicholas Hager. This is suggesting that for many Americans, everything we know is wrong about the founding of America. He's a writer for the London Times and the author of a brilliant new book, The Secret Founding of America, The Real Story of Freemasons, Puritans, and the Battle for the New World. Nicholas Hager, welcome.
Thank you.
And I should note your website is nicholashager.co.uk. And it's Hager with two G's and spelled beyond that conventionally. In your book, you start really the history of Freemasonry. I mean, this going all the way back to AD 496, the Merovingian dynasty?
It goes back, Freemasonry goes back arguably to ancient Egypt, and certainly.
So well before that.
Certainly to the. Masons who were making cathedrals, building cathedrals in the Middle Ages, but it was Bacon really who got it together. But I should just say that my book is actually pursuing two themes. It's the Christian founding, because the planters were all Christians. They were the Spanish Catholics, the Anglicans at Jamestown, and the Puritans in New Plymouth. But at the same time, there's this other strand, because when I looked at the founding in 1607, I found inconsistencies. There were feudings over the choice of site, for example. Also, they deposed each other, and there were two assassination attempts on John Smith. You'd think that the settlers would all want to be in the same boat, but there's something going on. There's some subplot that we haven't really discovered. And I looked at it, and I found a pamphlet by George Tudhope, Freemasonry Came to America with Captain John Smith in 1607. And that set me thinking. And the more I looked at it, the more I saw the hand of a secret organization at work in 1607. I have to say, I think the evidence is probably inconclusive. It's circumstantial, certainly. But if you project it forward to 1787, it's very, very strong.
I've seen in the Library of Congress the block print of the inaugural procession for George Washington, which was a Mason parade where the various people were carrying their Masonic Lodge numbers and all that sort of thing.
Absolutely. George Washington was a very prominent Freemason. The whole idea of federalism came from Anderson's Constitution of 1723, which was the Constitution, the written constitution for Freemasonry, which took 6 years to write. Mm-hmm. It worked so well in the lodges that the founding fathers imported it and introduced it into the American Constitution.
Now, how does this tie into things like the Priory of Sion and the Knights Templar? And by the way, let me warn my listeners, do not go to the websites Priory of Sion, S-I-O-N, or KnightsTemplar.com. Don't go to either one of those websites. Anyhow, Nicholas Hager, how does this tie into all that?
Well, certainly the Templars, because there were two main groups of Freemasonry. One founded by Bacon, the Elizabethan courtier, in the 1580s, based on the ancient idea, and the other on the Templars. Now, when the Templars were suppressed in the 14th century, a group fled to Scotland, and the Stuart kings of Scotland became Templars. They continued practicing, but in a kind of secret society, which became Freemasonic. And when James VI of Scotland became James I of England after Elizabeth I, he brought Templar Freemasonry to London with him.
That's what it would have been
James
in 16... what?
James's Town.
Yeah, exactly. Jamestown was named after James, and for that matter, Virginia was named after his predecessor, the Queen Elizabeth, who was the Virgin Queen. And I guess still is named after her. But
that Templarism was brought from the King James strand as well as from the Bacon side. Bartholomew Gosnold, who I know quite a bit about, having owned the house where he planned the Jamestown settlement, Bartholomew Gosnold was related to Bacon, and Bacon was an MP in the area, and they would have met many times.
Yeah. Now, I've written extensively about the association between Jamestown and the British East India Company and the early settling of this country as basically the first growth of imperialism. I wrote a book called Unequal Protection, and probably a third of the book is about that, and went back and got a lot of original documents from the 1700s and, throughout the 18th century. And it seemed to me that the East India Company was incorporated by Queen Elizabeth I in December 1st of 1600, and most of the stock was inherited by James, although it was also held by members of the House of Lords, the aristocracy essentially, and it was an attempt to compete with the trading companies of the Dutch, and primarily, although the Spanish was starting to get some steam too. Particularly with the discoveries of North America, in the late 1400s, and I'm curious, the two stories that I've known about the history of America. One, the Puritan story that we were founded on people seeking religious independence, which kind of ignores the history of the British, the 7 years that England was seized by the Puritans and the British rejecting them and saying, no, we'd rather have a king than a theocracy. And that's really what, led the Puritans here. But they came after Jamestown. And Jamestown was originally settled by folks on behalf of, I thought, the British East India Company. Now, you're bringing the Masons into it. What's the relationship here between the Masons and the British East India Company and the royal families?
The main connection between Jamestown and the East India Company, from my point of view, is Sir Thomas Smythe, who effectively ran the East India Trading Company for a while. In fact, from the same office in London, he was running America and India at the same time at one point. And he was the man who funded the Jamestown voyage, and he was a relative of Bartholomew Gosnold's wife, a cousin, and he was enormously influential in getting the voyage together in 1607. So I think he wore those two hats, and brought the East India expertise to the Jamestown voyage.
So from the founding of this country and from the first settling by Europeans of North America in the early 1600s in 1607, and through the Revolutionary War and the ratification of the Constitution in 1789, clearly the Masons were a major, if not the major, force.
Agreed.
How has the force of the Masons been since then? I mean, these days we think of Masons as kind of, you know, quaint, silly guys who have weird customs and are kind of marginalized. I mean, they were much more of a big deal in my grandfather's era, I think.
Yes, I think George Washington presided over more or less a Freemasonic state with the Masonic Bible that he was sworn in on and various symbols of Freemasonry that we can go into. But project it forward to today, I think Freemasonry is still very strong. They want a one-world government, which has been the aim of both Baconian and Templar Freemasonry. But I think in the 20th century, Masonry is transmuted into other groups. So while retaining their own forms, the Round Table, RIIA, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg Group, the Club of Rome, the Trilateral Commission, all these fairly secret organizations that don't encourage publicity and which influence presidents and prime ministers have grown up. In George Washington's day, all the politicians, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Washington himself, were Freemasons and met secretly and had discussions.
So you're suggesting that all these institutions are Mason as well. We only have a half a minute left. We're talking with Nicholas Hager, the author of The Secret Founding of America. Quick question. We had a guest on about a year ago who was suggesting that the Mormons imported the Mason idea of secret underwear and a whole bunch of other, you know, the Joseph Smith basically cloned Masonry in the form of Christianity and created the first American Christian religion, Mormonism. If Mitt Romney becomes president, I mean, is this the reinvention of Masonry or was that person wrong?
Who knows? Who knows? It may be, but Freemasonry wants a one-world government with all the nation-states being United States of the world. That's where they're heading. And
that's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line, with America, your country and mine, being states underneath their...
Well, it's also what the it's what the transnational corporations want. Are they Freemasons?
Sorry, which corporation?
Well, stick around for just I have one more question for you, Nicholas, if you don't mind. We're talking with Nicholas Hager, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
You spin to the right, then spin to the right, then spin to the right again. Then you spin clockwise, spin to the starboard, spin to the right, and then you move a little bit abrupter. You're our nation's finest interrupter. Yours is the last word and first word. All the words in between and a rude outburst word.
Shut up!
Making bully.
O'Reilly.
No, O'Reilly.
Yes, O'Reilly. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Nicholas Hager on the line with us. NicholasHager.co.uk, his new book, The Secret Founding of America. Nicholas, this is the thing that I find really fascinating about conspiracy theories that suggest that it's all about a one-world government. On the right, there was... for back in the 60s, I remember reading John Stormer's None Dare Call It Treason and about how there is this one-world conspiracy. There's the anti-Semites who are convinced that there's a one-world Jewish conspiracy. There are people who are convinced that there's anti-Catholics who are convinced that there's a one-world Papist conspiracy. You've got the one-world Masonic theory here. And as, you know, looking around at the world, The one world theory that I subscribe to is that we've got a bunch of transnational corporations with largely interlocking boards of directors. If you go to theyrule.net, you can actually see how these corporations interlock their boards. And it's a small handful of people and a small handful of corporations that represent the vast majority of the wealth and power in the world, and that are through the World Trade Organization, things like that, actually making the rules for the world. Are you suggesting that, though, first of all, if you accept my premise, are you suggesting that those institutions, those multinational and transnational corporations, are actually fronts for the Masons?
Well, as I was saying before the break, I think in the 20th century, most of the leaders have links to the organizations I was mentioning, which are sub-Masonic, not actually Templars and Baconian Masons. There aren't enough hours in the day to be a president or a prime minister and belong to more than a couple of two or three groups. So I think Freemasonry has changed its shape, but I certainly take your point that the New World Order, which is a Masonic aim, is linked to the transnational corporations now.
So it was Bush Sr. who declared the New World Order, and publicly, and he was a member of Skull and Bones, as is his son and as was John Kerry. Is Skull and Bones tied into all of this?
Well, Skull and Bones arrived about 1833, 3 years after the death of Adam Weishaupt, who founded the Order of the Illuminati in 1776. And it has been reported that it is possibly a German offshoot, possibly of the Order of the Illuminati itself. But I don't think too much significance should be set by what an undergraduate does at college. This has been there for all those years. And
well, except for the fact that a lot of those Skull and Bones members end up doing favors for friends 40, 50 years later.
Sure.
I mean, it becomes a network. I'm curious if this ties in. I interviewed Willifred Diam, the professor in Vienna who wrote the book Der Mann, der Hitler Ideengebt, in German, the book about Fritz von Liebenfels, the fellow who wrote Astara, the magazine that gave Hitler the whole idea back in the 1920s, and he gave us an enormous. We were writing a book at one point about the religion of the Nazis, and he laid out a whole theory about the what you might say the Thule Society. He pronounced it Thule Society, T-H-U-L-E, which was a secret society that involved blood initiations and rituals that seemed to me strikingly similar to Skull and Bones, and in some ways to some of the darker descriptions of some of the Masonic offshoots. Was Hitler's Thule Society that morphed into the Nazism and the SS similar to the Masons in the United States that morphed into the United States of America?
Yes, I would agree. I've written about this in The Syndicate, which can also be found on the website, and also a very long epic poem about the Second World War, where the main characters are Eisenhower and Hitler, and the fall of Berlin is the fall of Troy, as it were, where the Thule Society features really quite prominently, and Dietrich Eckart, who introduced Hitler, introduced Hitler to the occult.
Yeah, Dietrich Eckart was the guy, along with there was a general whose name I'm forgetting, and Georg Fritz von Liebenfels, in fact, we saw Diam showed us a movie that was made in the 1920s of a fundraising meeting that included Henry Ford and a couple of other American industrialists that took place in Switzerland for the Thule Society, where these guys are all showing up in these long black coats and they're going into this giant castle keep, and it was absolutely bizarre. I'm sure you're familiar with all this stuff. But so
I think those running the world wanted Hitler to unify the world, and when he wasn't doing very well, they then switched to Stalin. And since the Berlin Wall came down, we see the New World Order spreading, and we're waiting to see what the next step will be. And I think that's the history of the 20th century, in a word.
And how does this play in? We just have a few seconds left, I guess. This plays then into the corporations and the political parties in America still. It's still in power.
Yes, there is a network of people, I call them the syndicate in the book The Syndicate, which is a network of families that are associated for a common enterprise. We're seeing the Christian and the Freemasonic woven together at different times very strongly.
Fascinating. Nicholas, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us. Nicholas Hager, The Secret Founding of America, The Real Story of Freemasons, Puritans, and the Battle for the New World.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jerry Falwell died yesterday at the age of 73. The fundamentalist preacher who brought us the moral majority. And I want to talk briefly about this because I think it's something ultimately that touches all of our lives. And I don't mean Jerry Falwell in the context of the damage that he did to this country, in my opinion. His trying to insert religion into politics and for that matter, politics into religion and the bigotry and hatred that he promoted. But also, let us not forget that this is a guy who started his life in a spiritual pursuit. And frankly, I'm willing to believe that he probably had a spiritual pursuit all his entire life. And I think it's important, and Jerry Falwell is a great example of highlighting the difference between spirituality and religion. Between this extraordinary sense of awe and an institution that can be used as a force of power. I remember when I must have been 7 years old or so, just a little kid. And there was an older, and I think of them as an elderly couple. They were probably in their 50s or 60s. Maybe let's say their mid-60s. This older couple who had a farm. I was living in Lansing, Michigan, and there was a group of us. There was a local church group, and in the summer, they took us out to their farm. A bunch of kids, 8, 10, 12 kids from the local church. At that time, it was the Kendon Drive Church of the Nazarene that we were going to. And a bunch of kids were out playing ball, and I was sitting at this little card table on the back lawn of this farm in central Michigan with this old guy who was this farmer. And we're just the two of us sitting there and drinking lemonade and looking out at the lawn. There's about an acre of lawn, and then beyond that there was a broken kind of line of trees, and beyond that you could see just miles of corn and crops, wheat growing and things. It was a beautiful summer day. The sky was a deep, deep blue, and there were these puffy white cumulus clouds moving slowly through the sky. And I remember the crows, the large black crows, you know, flying around, and there were other birds flying. You could hear all of nature all around. You could smell it. He had cut the grass the day before because we were coming, and you could still smell the fresh-cut grass. I remember all that very vividly. And this is why. Because as we're sitting there talking, me in the wisdom of being 7 years old, you know, and I say it facetiously, this guy leans over and he says to me, you know, across the table, this little card table about 3 feet square separating us, he says, "Look out there at the sky, that blue sky." And I'm like, "Yeah." And the clouds. He says, "You know, there's stars and planets beyond that." And I said, "You can see them at night." Yeah. And he says, and look at the trees. And look at the clouds. And just notice, you know, smell the grass. And see those birds. And he's going through, and I'm seeing and I'm hearing and I'm feeling everything that's there. And then he leans over in this very conspiratorial voice. He says, "It's all alive." And in that moment, something just absolutely washed over me, just absolutely overwhelmed me of this connection, this feeling of absolute connection with everything that was alive that I was looking at. And it was such a powerful, and I mean, it shocked me, it rocked me right to the core of my being. And I've touched that place in my life a number of times in my life, and I am convinced that there are some people who live in that place all the time. A dear friend of mine, Mike Hutchison, in Santa Fe, broke his neck, is paralyzed from the neck down, and had this extraordinary enlightenment experience. If you go to TomHartmann.com or KnightsTemplar.com and click on the ecology link, it says politics/ecology on the left. And that'll take you to my main political and ecology page. And then you click on the rants link and scroll about halfway down the page. You'll see a thing called Mike Hutchison on enlightenment. The URL is actually TomHartmann.com/Hutchison, HUTCHISON.SHTML. And in that, he talks about his experience of suddenly knowing that there is no I, there's just all of it. And I realize this is getting kind of esoteric, and I'm not going to take it much deeper than this, but just let me recommend that to you. And I remember when I went to meet Pope John Paul II, and sitting there with him for about an hour and a half, and then talking with him briefly when Louise and I were brought up and presented and had an opportunity to speak with him in kind of semi-private. And reading his autobiography, Crossing the Threshold of Hope, as I recall, is the title of it, and his talking in his autobiography about how he had an experience as a child that was sort of similar to the one that I had, and he spent the whole rest of his life trying to get into that place where he could hang out in that place all the time. And you read the book, and it's really quite sad, actually, that he never got there. He never experienced, what the Buddhists would call enlightenment. Although he touched it from time to time. And I am convinced that that is an absolute, real, and human experience. It transcends everything else. And that's probably where Jerry Falwell started. My experience has been that that's where most people who pursue religion, particularly religious institutions, start. And then it goes wrong. It goes wrong when it becomes political. It goes wrong when it becomes contaminated by ego. It goes wrong when it's like, let's turn this into an instrument of power. It goes wrong when let's get some government grants. It goes wrong when George Bush says, yeah, we'll give $1 billion to faith-based initiatives in 2004 to get the churches on our side. It goes wrong when religious leaders are saying we need to suppress the vote. It goes wrong when religious and Republican leaders like Paul Weyrich talk about...
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote.
That's where it goes wrong. I mean, it's that kind of thing. That's where it goes wrong. And tragically, I view Jerry Falwell's life as a tragic life. Tragically, it went wrong. And so, I am not going to be one of those to trash him. I'm not going to be one of those to praise him. I think he's a human being just like all the rest of us. And I believe that, he's moved into the light, into the one, into what it all is. But without getting into theology and all that, I just wanted to make that point. I think that it's important increasingly in our society as religion is driving political policy, as religion is driving people to suicide attacks, whether it be Tim McVeigh or whether it be Osama bin Laden, as religion to mass murder, as religion is driving domestic and foreign policy, that we understand that there's a difference between spirituality and religion. And that, frankly, I honor spirituality very, very highly. and I am very wary and very suspicious of religion. And I say that as somebody who calls himself a Christian because I, you know, I, well, without getting into the whole, with that whole rant, that's a whole other one. Joe in Los Angeles. Let's get back to politics. Joe in Los Angeles. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I just wanted to say I really appreciate your show. I think you present a smart show and just present the facts, and I really appreciate that. Let the other side come up with the lies. But what I wanted to comment on was earlier you had mentioned the vote that took place in the Senate this morning on the Iraq war, and you had commented that even Harry Reid voted against it. And
on reflection, Harry Reid probably voted against it so that he could bring it back up again, right?
That's exactly what I was calling about. Because it occurred to me that Bill Frist, when he was majority leader last year on some important piece of legislation, he did the same thing when he saw that it wasn't going to pass.
Right.
And that occurred to me as well.
Yeah. So I shouldn't have been picking on Harry Reid. Thanks for setting that straight, Joe.
I just think it's important to remember that, you know, even though the Democrats don't have enough votes, it does seem to me like they are trying to make progress. And in the Senate, it's difficult because you need 60 votes for cloture. So,
Anyway. Good point. And thank you very much for making it. I appreciate it. Seth in Brooklyn. Hey, Seth, just a half a minute here before we got to take a break. Good afternoon, Tom.
Yeah, just really briefly about what you were talking about before, about the spirituality. I agree with you. I find that most people overcomplicate their relationship with God, and I don't know exactly why they do it.
Because we're humans.
Yeah, I guess, and it seems to vary from person to person as to exactly what it is that gets in the way. For me, I had drug and alcohol problems, and I started to get real close to God again when I got sober, you know. And it doesn't matter what you call it, or it's just, you know, just got to try.
Yeah, I like how AA does the thing, you know, about the greater force.
About.
I mean, you know, I'm not a member of AA, but I honor it, and I'm not an alcoholic, but I honor the whole thing. It's just, you know, the idea of there's a force greater than us, and we'll leave it at that. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
WMDs. $500 billion down the toilet, please. That's no big deal, but convicting little Scooter ain't fair. You're poking the bear. W knows what's just and what's fairest. Put me in jail if you think I'm a terrorist. But nailing a guy for outing a spy curls my hair. You're poking the bear. You're poking the bear.
Yeah, that's what Limbaugh said we're doing. He says, poking the bear. Can't have that. Anyhow, hey, by the way, tomorrow, this afternoon, flying off to Denver, tomorrow I'll be doing the live show from the Boulder Theater, 9 a.m. to noon, am760.net for tickets and information, am760.net if you're in the Denver area, and on Saturday, we'll be at the Greer Garson Theater in Santa Fe for a presentation and book signing. And Jim Turr, whose music you're hearing there in the background, is going to be opening the gig for us. That should be a lot of fun to see my old friend Jim again. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Bob in Queens, New York. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Tom, how are you?
I'm fine.
Aside from the abortion issue, where people legitimately feel that human life is being destroyed, there's a multiplicity of reasons of why fundamentalist Christians should vote Democratic. From the environmental issues, you know, not defiling God's green earth, to greed, to issues of greed, to helping the poor, to turning the other cheek. Aside from the abortion issues, they should be voting Democratic. Now, let me say one other thing. You know the freedom of religion clause in the Constitution?
Yeah, there's actually twice in the Constitution.
And doesn't that include the freedom to not believe?
Sure. Actually, the Constitution, the two prohibitions against religion in the Constitution, one says that there should be no religious test for somebody to be an officer in government. And the second, and that's built into the body of the Constitution itself. I believe it's in Article 1, as I recall. But it might be beyond that. It might be like Article 4 or 5. In fact, it must be. In any case, and the second is the First Amendment. And the First Amendment says that there shall not, for all practical purposes, be an official state religion. In other words, the government shall not endorse a religion. Neither one says people have to believe or can't believe or any of that sort of thing. So, Tony in Brooklyn, New York. Tony, you want to disagree with me? Tony?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you're on the air.
What I was going to say was that spiritualism is like in an absurd realm. There's no reason.
Now, I'm not an advocate of spiritualism, which is a religion. I'm an advocate of spirituality, which is a personal experience.
No, no, I understand that. But I'm saying that the people that play with spirituality, they know how to create this concept of losing the self. And when you buy into losing the self, you're no longer accountable to anything because now you're part of this amorphous, non-self world. And
well, actually, I think that, you know, Buddhist thinkers who are probably the most articulate proponents of that, although you'll find Meister Eckhart writing about this very eloquently, and St. John of the Cross, I mean, read his collected writings, or St. Teresa of Avila, read Interior Castle by St. Teresa. You will find all of these principles in the books of the great mystics of the Christian religion, as well as in Judaism, as well as in Hinduism, and in Buddhism. And I would submit to you that in every case, what they would say is that, in fact, you, as a consequence of that experience, you become even more responsible, as it were, because you get it that we're all connected, that it is all one. And there isn't an us and a them. I mean, that was the essence of that was my takeaway message from spending a week with the Dalai Lama, for that matter. John in Los Angeles, California, on K-Talk. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. Hey, you had made a point. You had said earlier that you can't make a point based on a false predicate. Yet you had said that Timothy McVeigh was an evangelical.
What? No, I said that he was a Christian. He was part of the.
You said yesterday that he was an evangelical as well.
Oh, did I?
He was raised a Roman Catholic as a child. Then he was agnostic at the end, wasn't he?
Well, you know, reading. Did you read Gore Vidal's book about him?
Yeah, I haven't read the book about him. I just read the biographical on the Expedia. And it says he was raised Roman Catholic, but he was agnostic in his adult life.
Yeah, Gore Vidal interviewed him extensively, and it's been a while since I read the book, which I found fascinating. But his Bible, as it were, Tim McVeigh's, I agree with you, he wasn't an evangelical, but his Bible was the Turner Diaries. And the Turner Diaries, the essence of the Turner Diaries, which is what he was trying to recreate. In the Turner Diaries, you've got this guy who's a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, right? A good white Christian guy who brings down the wrath of the government by blowing up a federal building. And the government's overreaction of taking away people's liberties causes all the good white Christian God-fearing gun owners to get out on the streets and take down the government. And that was what Tim McVeigh was all about and what he was trying to do. But you're correct in pointing out that he was not an evangelical, and if I said that yesterday, I apologize. You're correct. Lerone in New York City. Hey, Lerone, where you at?
Hey,
about a minute
you
before. Hey.
I just want to make a comment about Giuliani. You know, I'm from New York. I'm born and raised in New York. And I would just like the people outside of New York to know that New York is more than just Manhattan. New York has five boroughs: Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, Bronx, and Staten Island. Manhattan maybe had done well under Giuliani, but the outer boroughs have seen very little results from what he's saying that he's done.
Well, and in fact, my understanding, and I have a dear friend who lives in New York who I stay with usually when I'm there, and I've known for years, Jerry Schneiderman, my best friend for the last 30 years. My sense of it was, and I was there a lot in New York during the Giuliani years, because Jerry and I owned a business together that was based in New York City. I was there every month. My understanding was that basically what Giuliani was doing was he was taking homeless people and exporting them from Manhattan into the other boroughs.
Exactly. And some of the crime figures that he's citing, during those times when the conflicts were coming down, there was a big controversy about how the commanders and the precincts were recording the crime.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, they were playing with the numbers, and they were also playing them from borough to borough and all kinds of things. Giuliani does not represent New York. Well said. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be disagreeing with conservative Peter Ferreira on the question, should all crimes be considered hate crimes, or do cons even know what hate crimes are? Marcus Mabry, the editor of Newsweek, is here about his new book, Twice as Good, Condoleezza Rice and Her Path to Power, and as always, the best of the rest of the news. Plus, we'll be live in Denver, so be sure to check that out. And don't forget, democracy starts with you. Tag you. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.